please.
William H. Gordon Associates, Inc. versus Heritage Fellowship United Church of Christ.
All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Shoemaker, and it's my pleasure to introduce James Lee, Bard in the state of Maryland and in Washington, D.C., who will be arguing for you today. He's previously been admitted pro bono.
All right, thank you very much. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, the case today essentially amounts to a contractual allocation of responsibility rewritten by the trial court in this case. There is no dispute of fact that the contractor, Whitener & Jackson, did not build the rain tank system designed by my client, William H. Gordon Associates. They failed to build the system that was designed by my client in two separate ways. First, they admit that they used material that was different and lower strength than that specified in the contract documents. Second, on page 18 of our opening brief, there is a listing of eight separate things they did in the installation of this system that were not in accordance with either the contract documents or their own rain tank submittal installation guide, such things as using oversized rock, the wrong soil, wrong compaction, and the dynamic compactor for the soil that was three times the weight recommended by the manufacturer.
Counsel, procedurally, your position is there were construction defects that were the proximate cause.
That's the
your opponent's position is there were design defects that were the proximate cause. And obviously there are, it's possible to have both design and construction defects. But is it not a finding of fact that we're dealing with, where the trial judge looked at all the facts and said, based upon the facts, I find that the proximate cause was solely on your client's shoulders?
No, Your Honor. Respectfully, I disagree. There were two causation experts that testified. Mr. Phil Reedy testified on behalf of the Heritage. Mr. Phil Scharf testified on behalf of Whitener Jackson. Mr. Scharf's conclusion was that the material that was installed was inadequate in strength to withstand the loads that were imposed upon
it. Yeah, but expert opinions are not matters of law. They're matters of fact. And that's what his question was. Isn't this case a factual decision based upon a trial court, which is only subject to reversal if it's plainly wrong or without evidence to support it?
Your Honor, the design defect that is alleged in it is the sealing of the plans, not the representation of the manufacturer and the contractor as to the strength of its materials. The strength of the materials was a representation of the contractor and a design requirement that they did not meet.
I think you're missing Justice Mims' question, and he's certainly capable of handling this all by himself.
You're doing it very well.
But he's asking you, is this a matter of fact or is this a matter of law? That's the simple question.
And I believe it is a matter of law, because there must be a causation connection between the breach of the standard of care and the cause of the incident. The breach of the standard of care has not been tied to anything that my client did. The causation evidence in the record...
Well, certainly that's a correct statement of law. But the trial court said, I find, as a fact, that these things have been met and your client is liable. So your burden is to determine on the record what's inadequate about her findings.
There are two things. She could not find that the contractor had complied or even materially complied with the contract documents in its construction of the project or in the material it used. The undisputed evidence of record was that both were wrong. She called it a non-material defect, but the contract documents themselves do not allow for a material-immaterial distinction. The contract documents requires a matter of law, the law of the case, the D.C. McLean case, that the contractor either conforms to the contract documents or removes and replaces it so that he does conform to the contract documents. That issue of law is a contract interpretation based on the undisputed facts. There's no dispute but that the contractor did not comply with his construction contract and the design engineer is being held responsible for the failures of that contractor to conform to the construction contract and the design.
But the final order goes on to say all of those adjustments are not approximate cause of the collapse.
And the problem with that, Your Honor, is neither the trial court, for whatever reason, pointed to a specific proximate cause, nor in the record is there anything in the opposition that points to the substantial evidence that shows...
Well, the very next sentence says the court has found that the sole proximate cause of the damages was the failure of Gordon to meet the minimum standard of care as an engineer required by the contract.
I agree. That's what it says, Your Honor, but there must be something in the record to tie that finding of causation to something that my client did. It's negligence in the air that Judge Cardozo doesn't want. There's nothing about signing and sealing plans with inadequate knowledge in 2007 that causes a contractor to produce inadequate materials and install it incorrectly.
Can I rephrase the question this way, counsel? I'm sure I'm overgeneralizing, but for purposes of just keeping the dialogue, you got allegedly crummy design, and you got allegedly crummy installation. All right, the tank could have fallen because of both. Crummy design, put in wrong, and it collapsed. Or it could have fallen and need replacing. The design wasn't any good, but that's not why it fell. It fell because it was put in wrong. Or, alternatively, it could... No matter how well you put this thing in, the design was so flawed it was going to fall apart on its own. We have a trial judge who's sitting through all of this testimony, and she says, you know, I've heard it all, and it appears to me that by a preponderance, which is 51%, so we're not talking about absolute certainty, you know, 100% of the cause of why this thing fell apart was the design part of the job. Now, we can go into later debates as to liability for design flaws, as you have on brief, but just on that one point, is that an irrational fact-finding on behalf of the fact-finder to come to that conclusion?
I'm loath to call any judge irrational, sir, but in this particular case, the design defect alleged is that we sealed plans containing a requirement that the material be 34 PSI without understanding why it should be. That's the design defect. And we relied on the manufacturer's representations as to the strength of its material in doing that. There are two separate calculations by the experts for Heritage and Whitener and Jackson in which they did structural calculations which are alleged to have been required by my client, and in both instances those calculations indicated that the system, if installed in accordance with the contract documents and in accordance with the contractor's grain tank submittal, it would not have failed and we would not be here. It would be working as required. And so what the trial court did was to make the contract interpretation that the failure of the contractor to conform to the contractor's contract documents is trumped by a perception that a breach of the standard care occurred when the design engineer didn't really understand all of the manufacturer's representation.
Okay, well, what about the October and 2010 communications between the contractor and the design engineer?
I believe that those would be covered by this court's holding in Nelson v. Commonwealth. If you buy that issue that the design should have been revisited in 2010.
Well, it was revisited.
Well, the question was raised, but that doesn't start the trigger of the statute of limitations, which began back in 2007 when my client signed and sealed the plans. By the opposition, they would argue that asking a question about the design and questioning it in 2010 somehow restarts the statute of limitations on a design defect claim. And this court held in BMI King that begins at the moment that the injury occurs, and that's when the plans are tendered and accepted. Clearly these plans were tendered. Clearly these plans were accepted because they were submitted to the authority.
But then in November of 2010, they were approved as revised.
The revisions, as a matter of record, Your Honor, had nothing to do with the design of the rain tank system. If you look at, I believe it's at the Joint Appendix 1331, you will see the whole series of drawings. There are architectural, mechanical, electrical, plumbing. The site plan and the permit process went on from 2007 when it began, long into 2009. But the design of the rain tank system never changed.
Look at 1342 and tell me what your client was doing on that document.
I have to pull that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can you tell me what document it is?
1342. It's dated November of 2010.
Is it the response to the request for interpretation?
Yes.
It's a simple question by the contractor to the design engineer, which is covered in the general construction contract that happens on every job, as to whether the depth of cover in the water is sufficient. The engineer went back to the manufacturer, determined from the manufacturer that they didn't have a problem with it, and the manufacturer testified at trial that there was no problem with it, as did Heritage's expert, Mr. Reedy. So the record before the court is that, yes, there was a question posed, but there was not a breach of the standard of care because nothing changed in the design. Simply saying, I still think my design is fine, doesn't start the clock over for a design defect.
Actually, it was approved as revised.
What's approved as revised is a shop drawing. And if you go look...
Okay, so, all right, well, I understand your point.
And I thought also the issue was raised that when that call was made, that was it was a cause of action based upon the construction coordination requirement that you all had under your contract. So it was not necessarily restarting a statute of limitations concerning the design, but rather it was a cause of action based upon your failing to reach the standard of care in providing construction coordination services.
The issue of construction administration services was never connected by the court to the causation of any failure. The only causation evidence in the record comes back to. So accepting that the court can find negligence caused by construction administration or caused by design, it doesn't change the issue of causation. There's nothing in the record of the only people that testified on causation that connects the alleged negligence that's in the record to the causation of the failure. The causation of the failure is either the material was inadequate and not as represented by the manufacturer, or the construction was inadequate and not as required by the contract documents and the rain tank submittal.
What about W&J's experts who testified that the collapse was a result of faulty design that failed to take into account certain key factors and flawed installation instructions received from you all?
The flawed installation instructions are those installation instructions that are in the contract documents and also in the rain tank submittal represented by the contractor as how he will go ahead and do it. We adopted into the design documents the same installation instructions from the manufacturer that the contractor then submitted more installation instructions as his submittal. That failure to conform to the approved submittal is a breach of the construction contract, not the design contract. The design agreement allows me to reasonably rely on the accuracy and completeness of third-party information, such as the manufacturer information on the quality
of
the
material. I'm sorry to interrupt
your
mid-sentence, but in reply to Justice Goodwin's question, didn't you just hit the nail on the head reasonably?
No, sir, because I'm assuming for the purposes of our argument that we did breach the standard of care. We're not making an argument on the facts of whether we breached it. We're saying that there was no causation. The breach was at the time of design, and the statute of limitation bars it. And the contract allocating responsibility for inadequate construction and inadequate materials, the construction contract and the design agreement, put that solely on the contractor. And to...
So if I heard you correctly, you're not contesting the existence of a duty being breached. You're contesting only causation on appeal.
We cannot, and we did not, and do not, we said that in our opposition, appeal. We don't agree with it. We think the judge was wrong, obviously, but that is not our issue on appeal. As the 9 AMICA, 3 national organizations, 6 regional organizations offered, there is no need to reach the standard of care to reverse this case and enforce the contracts as written. That's the crux of our appeal. We want the contracts enforced as written and not rewritten because of a breach that offended the trial court. That's not the basis for deciding breach of contract cases. D.C. McLean, that this court decided in 1995, says the contract is the law of the case. There is nothing in the appellate briefs of the Heritage that explains why they have reversed course and said that the contract interpretation they advanced at trial is now the opposite they advance here on appeal. The fact of the matter is the contract interpretation by the court, based on the facts, as a matter of law, is unsupported. And we believe that it should be enforced by this court. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Matt, I have one last question. If the trial court awarded the church the damages for the rain tank on the church's direct action against Gordon rather than in the third-party action, I know they were consolidated, but would you still contend that you can rely on the church's contract with the general contractor?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that if that had happened, but it didn't happen, but if it had happened, the church would not have been able to recover damages because we're not responsible for the contractor's failure to carry out the work as a matter of our design agreement and as contained within the construction contractor. The construction contractor is responsible for all that he does being in accordance with the contract documents. He can't shift that, and the Heritage can't shift the contractor's failings to us, because paragraph 17 of our design agreement says specifically that we're not responsible for the acts or omissions of the contractor. Thank you.
Please the court. I'm Tom Folk, representing the Appalachian Heritage Fellowship Church, and with me at council table are my colleagues, Allison Tepp and Miles Dumville. Mr. Dumville is the one with the lighter hair.
We know him well.
I think as the number of questions from the court indicate, the court understands that this was a two-week bench trial. There were over 20 witnesses, there were seven expert witnesses that the court considered, and that the standard is very high for the appellant here to have it reversed. I wanted to comment on several things that appellant's counsel said during their argument. First, he's characterized the design defect as the designer didn't understand a number that was provided from the manufacturer. And that's not it at all. There was, if you look at the appendix, pages 710 to 783, the testimony of Mr. Houlihan, there were numerous violations of the standard of care by this design professional, which included that essentially the design professional didn't even consider any of the information. They simply took and cut and pasted about four sheets of documents that had a number of pages on each sheet that was a design of a structure. And in Virginia, a design of a structure must be by a Virginia licensed engineer. In this case, what they cut and pasted was provided by a vendor, ACF Environmental, which was not an engineering company, had no engineers, didn't have any engineers on retainer, and in fact said, we don't represent ourselves to be engineers. We understood that Gordon was supposed to be designing this structure, and it was a structure as found by the court in the final order, appendix 1809, and it's testified to by three different engineers. It's a structure because of reasons of public safety. It has to be designed by a licensed engineer. The only licensed engineer involved was Gordon, and they abdicated that responsibility.
May I ask you this?
Yes, sir.
On the causation issue, once again using an overgeneralization, bad design, bad installation, trial court said the sole cause was bad design. Well, I went, and I'm sure you've done this a dozen times, through all of the expert testimony on the subject, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, it seems to me that the import of all of it was there were concurring causes, that neither side could say, but for mine, this would not have happened or would have happened. Is there something clear in the expert testimony where the trial court could say, you know what, it doesn't matter that there might have been crummy installation. This would have fallen because of crummy design no matter what, which would be a sole proximate cause?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked. I was going to point to the court during closing argument. There was a colloquy between Mr. Shoemaker, who was giving Gordon's closing argument, and between then Judge Roush. And Mr. Shoemaker was saying, well, gee, we've got this evidence that these green tanks are made out of these plastic plates. And forgive me if I elaborate on this a little bit, but I think it's important to help understand the context of the answer. They're made out of these plastic plates. There were over 3,000 modules on this site, approximately 150 foot by 75 foot footprint. 3,000 modules, 8 plates per module. The way you assemble the things, there are 2 horizontal plates and there are 6 vertical plates. That means each of the vertical plates is a column that supports a load. That means you have 18,000 vertical columns to support the load. And the church's experts, Mr. Reedy and Dr. Bacchus, said it's really important that these things be almost perfectly vertical. At the same time, you heard from standard care experts saying, well, gee, they didn't consider groundwater. They didn't consider the rock, which made it virtually impossible to remove the groundwater. The groundwater makes it hard or not obtainable to get the kind of flat base you need because these things are very sensitive and it's important to keep the columns vertical.
But the root causation experts say, you know what, no matter how well you put this design in, it still going to fail.
Well, what I was going to read to you, this is what Judge Roush said after hearing 8 days of testimony, 7 experts. He said, if this system has to be so perfectly installed, and the fact that it's put together on a site like Legos or plates that snap together, why don't they just manufacture it as a unit that are perfectly true? And then she goes to say, I think it's pretty close to a highly delicate system if these things have to be perfectly true and perfectly square when they're assembled on the site. You have to square it off. You have to level it off. That is a ridiculous system to use on a site like this. You also had the evidence.
I'm with you completely. She held that crummy design was the sole proximate cause, and she gave the explanation. It's a brilliant explanation. My question is, are there any experts saying that? Because I'm looking for dividing concurrent causes into sole proximate causes.
There is no expert that says that conclusion, that the sole cause of the collapse was designed, except, well, actually, take that back. There are 2 experts, actually, that said that. Both were White and Jackson, the general contractor. One expert, Kiet Nguyen, essentially said that, look, they specified installing below the groundwater table, which the contractor specifically asked about. He said, well, hey, look, you're not supposed to install this below the groundwater table. And they submitted what was Request for Information, RFI number 41, in October 2010. Said, hey, look, and what happens is the warden calls the vendor, who has no engineers on the staff, that, was it okay to install this? And the warden said, sure, go ahead, do it. They tell the contractor it's okay. They install the groundwater. And what Mr. Nguyen opined was that by having it installed under the groundwater, you wrap these 3,000 modules in this geotextile. Underneath it, you have these rocks that are relatively porous. He says, well, makes it for an unstable base. So you, essentially, similar to what Mr. Reedy and...
May I rephrase the question this way? The church's experts, obviously, were targeting both the engineers as well as the general contractor.
Yes, sir.
Obviously, things have changed now that you've got a ruling that only one of the two is liable.
Yes, sir.
Is there anything in the church's expert testimony that would provide a basis or a fact finder to say, you know what, I've heard everything, and I'm going to infer that while there were, in fact, concurrent causes going on, one of them was the only but-for cause?
I think in terms of you're looking simply at the church's 2 experts, if that's the question, and you're disregarding the Whitener and Jackson experts?
Well, let's start there with the church's experts. Did the church's experts claim that there were concurring causes that jointly caused the failure, or did they claim, as the trial court held, that one cause was the sole proximate cause? In other words, the but-for cause.
The in terms of the church's experts, no. What Mr. Reedy said is, and this I apologize, was not part of the appendix, although as you realize, the appendix itself is pretty voluminous. The record is much more voluminous. On the Mr. Reedy had a DeBenedetto deposition that was read in on day 7 of the trial on page 186 is the question that he put to him was, well, what I'm asking is this. You said one of the factors that caused the failure of the rain tank was inadequate construction and specifications. You agree with that, correct? That's one of your opinions? And he says, yes. He doesn't say it's the sole factor. He says it's one of the opinions. So what we've argued in our brief, and I think is what is true, is that the finder of fact is not bound to take everything that one witness says 100% or 0%. They can factor it in with the other evidence that they hear. And obviously, Judge Rausch, as you can tell, or then Judge Rausch, as you can tell from what I read from the appendix, was of the opinion that this system should never have been specified for this site. And you also had the testimony of experts, too, that the base was supposed to be very flat, but the specifications didn't really help the contractor figuring out what exactly that meant. And there was some confusion in terms of base versus the tolerances for the excavation. But the base, Mr. Houlihan said, the base specifications were very unhelpful. Mr. Reedy said the specifications were and not very clear. And then another factor, and I apologize on this one too, because I once again I failed to include it in the appendix, and I made a citation in our brief without citing to the record, is that the base that was used after they took the rain tank out, they put in another system made out of corrugated metal pipe, which is a more traditional system. And it turned out it was cheaper to do that, too, than to put the darn rain tank in. And they were able to use the base that was unsuitable for the rain tank for the corrugated metal pipe. And that appears in the record if you see Mr. Reedy's deposition, day 7, the Benny essay deposition, testimony, page 187, also 248. Also, William Tex Lloyd, the contractor who's built over 100 churches, there was a superintendent on the site who watched everything go in and said that the base was flat, that the site work subcontractor was even using a laser device to make sure it was flat, that these modules were all packed together tight, there weren't any gaps. He has 36 years of construction. He's also a member of our Heritage's congregation and said he was taking particular care because he wanted to make things were right for the church. So you have evidence that, and contrary to what appellant's counsel said, you have abundant evidence that the contractor followed the plans and specifications in their material respects.
If you'll permit me to change the subject again, if the bottom line here is this was a ridiculous system, as the trial court held, as I understand that remark, that means the design was completely inapplicable to this kind of situation. If that's true, and that's what was held, why isn't the accrual of that in January 2007? That's when the design was delivered and sealed and sent by the design professional, and I would think if that's the claim and that's the holding, that that's when it accrued and the statute of limitations would run.
Okay, I think for a number of reasons, Your Honor. First, there was, in the engineer contract, there was a statutory provision on accrual of statute of limitations which says that it accrued not later than substantial completion. It doesn't. You know, I know that the appellant makes the argument and say, well, gee, they're rewriting the thing, but actually I think they're rewriting that provision because they say, oh, what that really means, it accrues the earlier of either what the statute says.
Well, I have to confess, I could not understand what it meant. Not later than, it didn't make sense to me, and I couldn't find any case law even mentioning such a phrase. Can you explain it?
Yes, sir.
Counsel, was it not actually a date for determining the statute of repose rather than the statute of limitations?
No, Your Honor, it was an accrual provision. So it said that the contractual provision was an accrual provision that said the cause of action shall accrue not later than the date of substantial completion. And it didn't say that that was for purposes of statute of repose or statute of limitations. It said that any cause of action shall accrue not later than substantial completion.
Okay. I think you had not yet answered Justice Kelsey.
I'm sorry.
Not later than is not the same thing as at the time of. That's the only question I'm trying to figure out.
If that's the case, which is what our view is, then the cause of action accrued in 2012. There's a five-year statute of limitations plus a six-month tolling agreement. So we filed suit on April 29th, 2013, which is well within the five-year statute of limitations.
So you're saying accrual was 2012 by the contractual provision as opposed to 2010 at the time of the revisions of some of the shop drawings?
Yes, Your Honor. And what we're saying on the accrual as far as the design itself is 2009, because the contract, you have to look at the contract and read the contract in light of King. The contract is for final site plan. There was no approval of a final site plan until August of 2009. The drawings for construction were not presented by Gordon to the owner until June 2009. They were sent to the architect, depending upon to the construction contract for the contractor. So our argument on the statute of limitations simply is, first, the contractual provision that you cite says it accrues upon substantial completion, which is August 1st, 2012.
Well, it says not later than. I hate to keep interrupting you, but...
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. So what's the second ground for the statute of limitations not being accrued in 2007?
The second ground is if you disregard the contract and look at the King case, BMI versus King, okay, it accrues when you have you have approval by the owner. In this case, what the engineer is relying on is they're saying, the owner in December 2006 signed something on the front page of a site plan application and went through revisions for several years after that and didn't get approved until 2009 and said, we don't have any wetlands on this property. And that is approval by the owner of the plans. And that just doesn't fit under BMI versus King, because the design, even of the rain tank, came after that date. So you might as well say, well, when they entered into the contract, they authorized the engineer to pursue the site plan, so it accrued before they did any design work. And that's ridiculous. That is not what BMI versus King says. And then third, BMI versus King says, if you have issues of construction administration where the design professional is negligent, then the cause of action accrues at that time, which Mr. Houlihan said it was a separate violation of the standard of care in 2010, when the contractor, sort of like the canary in the coal mine, the contractor first, he says, can I put something else in? Can I put some concrete in? No, I can't do that. It has to be the Atlanta screen tank. Oh, by the way, the literature says, don't put it below groundwater. Go ahead, put it below groundwater. Oh, the literature says you can only have depth of cover between 18 inches and 36 inches. Those are the parameters for it. And you're falling for, actually, it's almost 10 feet of cover on this thing. That's brought to the engineer's attention in November of 2010. That's a separate violation of standard of care. It isn't just that they initially stamped something that, by statute, they shouldn't have stamped and they didn't understand. It's that when these different issues were brought specifically to their attention during construction administration, and it was brought out, look at the manufacturer's literature. You seem to be out of sync with that. All they do, they call up the vendor who has no engineers, violate the standard of care, according to our standard of care expert, Mr. Houlihan, and turns out to be a ridiculous design goes forward. It was ridiculous, but you had all these red flags, too, that I think under King would give rise to separate causes.
Before you run out of time, might I ask you a question about delay damages, which I think is the final assignment of the verdict. Is there any proof in the case that the church was out of pocket, any particular sum, owing solely to the delay in getting these things corrected and repaired? I know that you followed, I think, Roanoke Hospital case, or the judge did, in allowing payment of interest on the construction loan as the measure of that. But wouldn't you have been obligated under your contract with the lender to make those payments anyway over that period of time?
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but I don't think if you read the Doyle and Russell versus Roanoke Hospital, or I don't know if I've got the names reversed, but footnote 6 of that says essentially, and that case is probably a similar case in Virginia for construction lawyers on what's direct damages versus consequential damages. And what footnote 6 says is that you're entitled to the value of your investment loss while it's delayed, or the rental value. And for value of your investment, you can recover your interest on your construction loan during the period of delay. In other words, the church put in $14 million to have a new church. It was supposed to be ready December 5th, 2011. Wasn't ready until August 1st, 2012. They invested $14 million that they didn't get the benefit of this time, and Roanoke Hospital footnote 6 says that is a reasonable measure of the damages.
Yeah, but the church was able to use the property. As I understand it, the sanctuary was entirely, the parking lot use was somewhat diminished, but that the church accommodated that by having two services.
Your Honor, the church was not able to use any of the property until May 19th, 2012. So from December 5th to May 19th, they were paying interest and they weren't able to use the property.
But from May until August, you were able to use it. So at least with regard to that period of time, why do you even under Roanoke Hospital?
Okay, Your Honor, that amount is roughly $147,000. And I mean, the argument I put in the brief is first, there was a good part of the church we were denying use of, and also the damage calculation did not include any imputed interest on the over $2 million in cash that we put in that was part of under Roanoke Hospital. Footnote 6 also can impute interest on the money you put in, so that if you consider that, the roughly $147,000 is parametric damages.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal, four minutes and 40 seconds left.
Let me address, first of all, Justice Kelsey's question. The testimony on page 23 of the opening brief of the heritage causation expert was simply as follows. Question. Had the contractor constructed the project in conformity with the plans and specifications prepared by Gordon, as well as Whiteman and Jackson's proofs of middle, you believe to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty that the rain tank would be functioning today without having collapsed? Answer, yes. That was the videotape deposition that was 4 hours and was provided to Judge Roush in case. There is no causation.
What was that site?
Page 23. It's in the...
Page 23 of what?
Of the opening brief, Your Honor. And the
in the brief?
Of the opening brief of ours. And it's in the... the citation is on page 24, where in the record it is found.
Okay.
I'm sorry. There is no counter testimony from any expert that even if the contractor had built the project in accordance with the contract documents and the submittal, the system would have failed in the conditions in which it was.
Counsel, were the installation instructions part of the engineer's design?
There were some
installation instructions
in the contract documents.
And so that the engineer would have been responsible for those?
For the quality of those. And also in the submittal, there were installations. There were
Heritage
two sets.
Exhibit 152, if I'm reading this correctly, I conclude with a reasonable degree of engineering certainty that the loss, the collapse of the rain tank, was the result of an inadequately designed rain tank system coupled with inadequate, inconsistent installation instructions. Wouldn't that put the cause on the engineer?
Your Honor, that particular exhibit, 152, was examined at the petition for cert. I believe you asked the question of me then. At the time of trial, that exhibit was entered into evidence as a proof of denial of builder's risk insurance coverage because Heritage was taking the position that the damages sought by the contractor were in fact insured damages that had been waived by the subrogation clause in the construction contract. The person who signed that letter, which was attached to the insurer's letter denying coverage, never testified at trial. The letter was never referred to again by anyone in the courtroom from the time it was admitted to the time of
But it was admitted at trial.
It was admitted at trial as the insurer's denial letter with this attached letter from an engineer who never testified, who also said that there were construction errors in that same letter that caused the failure. But there is no testimony that the design, if built as required and in accordance with the submittal, that it would have failed.
What about the testimony from Mr. Scharf, S-H-A-R-F-F?
Mr. Scharf's testimony was that the failure was caused by the material not being as represented and that it was around 18 PSI instead of 34. And I should remind the court that the trial court excluded Mr. Scharf's testimony from being considered by the trial court as evidence of proximate cause in the Heritage case, the non-contingent claim. So in the non-contingent claim, which is over $850,000 roughly in damages, the only causation evidence is by Mr. Reedy, whose testimony I read to you a few moments ago. There is no testimony by Mr. Scharf that the court, over the objection of Heritage, which was not appealed, said, I'm not going to listen to Mr. Scharf as it relates to the independent case against Ford. I'm only going to listen to Mr. Scharf's testimony as it relates to the Whitener and Jackson case.
But in theory, that would make Scharf available for a holding on the 490, but not available on
that
the holding
correct,
for the
John.
8. It's sort of a peculiar circumstance, but it is what it is. Okay, you've got very little time left. Tell me again why the statute of limitations defense is irrefutable.
It's irrefutable because even when we get into 2010, the issues that are raised as design defects are in fact all in the 2007 plans that were signed, sealed, and accepted. Nelson v. Commonwealth says acceptance by the owner is part of the trigger, not permit approval in 2009.
What do you define as acceptance?
The VMI King Court said it was when the design professional could get paid for having finished the drawings. The evidence in front of the court here was similar to the evidence in Nelson, which is that the owner had accepted the plans by sealing it and submitting it to the authority having jurisdiction for permit.
Doesn't VMI versus King also say that it begins to run when the plans are finally approved? And their argument is these plans were finally approved when you included the rain tank into the submission, and that was August 5th of 2009. Why is that inaccurate?
The record will reflect that the drawings in 2007 actually had the rain tank in them at that time, and while there were changes to the drawings between 2000 and 2009 in response to comments from the authorities having jurisdiction, the rain tank never changed.
Well, why wouldn't the plans be final when all the changes had been made to it?
Because what's required is the engineer's signing and sealing says, I've finished the construction documents. I've handed them to the owner. The owner could say, I don't agree with you. That's not the house that I wanted. Go back and start over. That's acceptance. But once the owner takes those signed and sealed plans and submits it to the agency for permit review, it's clear that they've accepted what's shown in the drawings as dispositive of the design requirements of the engineer.
Yeah, counsel, if you were talking about a house, that's probably right. But let's talk about Fairfax County.
And a house in Fairfax County is the same, Your Honor.
Oh.
They're equally difficult to get permit out.
I think you're right about that. But as a practical matter, tell me if I'm mistaken. The party contracts for approvable plans, and you seal it. Your messenger takes it over to the client, who signs the submittal form, and then the engineer takes it to the county, and the county then spends what seems like several years having resubmission after resubmission after resubmission after resubmission, and finally, at some point, the county says, okay, now you can build. Now, if you have if you have contracted for a task as opposed to hourly work, isn't, as a practical matter, the task finished when the county says, yeah, you can go do it?
It was not the case in here. The delay in approval had nothing to do with the changes in the plan so much as the bonding capacity required, and it's practically stipulated in the record that we were not a cause of the delay. The problem that I see in the analysis...
When did the county, though, say these plans are now perfect, independent of...
I believe that the 2009 date is correct, that it was shortly after that they were approved for permit. The construction still didn't begin for some time after that.
Understood.
But there's nothing in the contracts that would allow that the difference in acceptance now is changed to permit issuance. That would be a change in the law.
No, it potentially affects our VMI King analysis. The contract is what it is. So, okay.
And just to voice the question you had, Your Honor, there's a case in the Fourth Circuit called Harbor Court versus Leo A. Daly, which interprets exactly the same contract language in the design agreement on the accrual, not later than. What that means is that causes of action may accrue before that, but the statute of repose and statutes of limitations begin no
ultimate cutoff date.
That substantial completion.
Thank you.
Your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.